Now more than ever, Lowe's knows you don't just want a low price, you want the lowest price. And with our lowest price guarantee, you can count on us for competitive prices on all your home improvement projects. If you find a qualifying lower price somewhere else on the same item, we'll match it. Lowe's, we help, you save. Price match applies to same item, current price at qualifying retailers. Exclusions and terms apply. Learn how we'll match price at lowes.com/lowestpriceguarantee.
Hi everyone, welcome to the Tech Entrepreneur on a Mission podcast. My name is Ton Dobbe and I'm the founder of Value Inspiration and the author of The Remarkable Effect. I envision a world where every B2B SaaS startup succeeds because they're creating software that customers would miss if they were gone. And here's why. Research consistently shows that 90% of all startups fail, and that's bad. What's worse, however, is that 75% of SaaS scale-ups fail, companies that are supposed to have product market fit. Far too few scale-ups create the traction they aspire for and fail for the wrong reasons. And I believe this should stop, and hence I created my business. And the goal that I have with this podcast is twofold. First, to inspire new forms of value creation by sharing compelling ideas and stories about the potential that we can unlock when technology and people blend in the right way. Secondly, share experiences from tech entrepreneurs like you about what it requires to create a remarkable software business and how to overcome the roadblocks to do so. The guest of the podcast this week is Max Fischer, founder and CEO of Deltia.
There's a lot of decisions, right, that you take, like both on the technical level and then like what kind of customers are you serving, who is the user that you're trying to focus on. And so we decided quite early on, for example, to not specifically target the Toyotas of the world, like the automotive OEMs who are basically the most, probably the best well-run manufacturing companies in the world. Also, there's use cases, obviously, also for our technology. I mean, there's no doubt about that, but I think a big opportunity is to help other, like the 98% other factories, to come to a similar level than Toyota or Volkswagen is today.
This is Max. He's a mechanical engineer. In 2014, he was a founding member of Hack Zurich, the largest hackathon Switzerland has ever seen. In 2015, he co-founded Actix and digitized over 40 factories. In this startup, he led product management, sales, and marketing teams. Meanwhile, he established himself as a thought leader in the space of digital transformation for the factory floor. And in November 2022, Max founded Deltia, a startup that is focused on helping factory operators track, analyze, and improve efficiency by identifying the best possible processes and assisting workers with digital tools. Their mission? To make human work in manufacturing more productive and less error-prone by taking out the guesswork. And that inspired me. And hence I invited Max to my podcast. We explore what's broken in identifying productivity opportunities in manufacturing. Max explains how, for the first time ever, this is possible. He shares some of the big lessons learned in building a company, especially when it comes to foundational questions like who's it for and what's it for, and how that helped them to remain highly focused. Last but not least, he elaborates on his first principles for building the platform and how that helps them to stay resilient and offer scalable solutions. And by listening to this podcast, you will learn four things. Firstly, why functionality is important, but not as important as system design. Secondly, how to go about building for business scalability rather than just technical scalability of your solution. Thirdly, why the dream is not to help global brands like Toyota or Volkswagen, but actually companies that are much smaller and much weaker. And lastly, what they are doing differently to accelerate stakeholder buy-in from IT, legal, and unions. Well, hi, Max. Thank you for making the time available today and being the guest on the podcast.
I don't know. Nice to meet you. Nice to be here.
Yeah, exactly. I reached out to you when I saw something on Strictly VC, which I sometimes follow just to figure out like what's going on in the software market, what companies are making moves, and you're definitely one of the ones that were mentioned there. We got a seed round. It itself doesn't like make me go yes, 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 but what your company is about made me pretty inspired, because my background at Unit 4 has a has a legacy in wholesale distribution, and I know how what are the challenges in those type of organizations. And it's fascinating what I saw, what how you're solving the problems of those type of companies these days. So that's why I wanted to have you on the call here. Before we start and talk about your company, Deltia, what drives you? What gives you energy as a person or as an entrepreneur?
I mean, it's a good question. So I think for us as a company and for me also personally, the impact that we can have is very important. So actually this, before Deltia, I founded another company. And before that, I was working in academia, doing a PhD in physical chemistry. And that was intellectually very interesting, working on like nanomaterials, things that though have an application mostly like 10, 15, 20 years in the future. And it was driven by having impact, like more impact faster, basically. I thought like being an entrepreneur is the best way to change something that you see you want to have changed. So that's definitely a thing that drives me, I would say.
Exactly. Well, that's a good transition to your company, because you said you were in academia and you also founded another company. You chose at the end the, how do you say it on your website, the kind of the companies with a shop floor. And I mean, for me, I saw on the pictures, I saw a lot of wholesale distribution type activity, but obviously it can be more manufacturing. What did you see in those type of organizations that were screaming for something different? Because it's been the focus of so many companies, one familiar one, SAP, for example, in Germany.
Yeah.
And what hasn't been solved that needed to be solved?
Yeah. So I think, first of all, for a lot of people, it might be surprising, but if you walk into a factory or like a warehouse, everybody is thinking about, I have only basically robots and everything is automated and there's raw material coming in and everything's automated and in the end, the final product comes out. But that's definitely not the case. I mean, there's 350 million people working on the shop floor. A lot of things, or like a factory can't operate without a human, right? Like even if you have an automated line, you still have a human setting up the machine, maintaining the machine, repairing the machine. But also a lot of products are assembled by human hands, like electronic components, smartphones, laptops, a lot of engines, cars, a lot of things are basically made by the human hand. And it will take a long time until we can really automate all of these processes. And these human processes are usually the ones which are least digitized and least understood. And I've seen this in my previous company. We built, I would say, more classical types of digitalization solutions, like tablet applications, where people can enter manually data, or we connect to machines and build analytics and dashboards, these sort of things. But which is useful, I mean, to get a general sense of how well operations are running, like how is your general productivity, what is the output for the day, for the shift, these sort of things. But these types of solutions never really explain why certain things are happening, especially on the human operations side. So in my previous company, we built, for example, solutions to track setup times of a machine. So a worker has a tablet and he can enter, start and stop of a setup process. Then he does something on the machine. Then you also maybe connect to the machine to track the output, which allows you to say, okay, what's the performance of the machine? How long was the setup operation? But that's it, basically it. If the setup operation took twice as long or like 50% longer, there was no information and no data about why there was a deviation. And if you asked the people themselves, they also sometimes can't really explain you what was different, right? They're very intuitive, especially the more experienced workers. They are more very intuitive in the way they're doing that. And that was basically something that triggered me to think about, there must be a better way of collecting shop floor information. Because still state of the art, even for very advanced companies like Toyota or Volkswagen, is that you have expert teams that walk the shop floor to collect data manually, like with a clipboard and a stopwatch, just to see, okay, what's happening here? Because there's no other way to really get rich information about what is happening apart from this high-level KPI tracking. And that's basically what I saw. I mean, in my previous company, we digitized around 40 factories, and none of them, big or small, had a solution for this problem, basically. And I mean, human operations are extremely critical, right? Like, also for us as a society, if you think about all the things that we need to do, change to carbon-free economy, like solar panels, wind turbines, electric cars, heat pumps, these sort of things, all of these things cannot be manufactured without humans. And
exactly.
So we need to basically digitize that, because especially a lot of people don't want to work in factories anymore because it's like a very hard job, right? It's physically strenuous, and so we need to become more and more productive to at least keep the output or increase the output that our factories are producing today. Yeah?
Exactly. Well, the other thing, of course, is also that there's a ongoing war for talent. I mean, there's simply less people in the workforce, so you have to do something different.
Correct. Yes.
Yeah. Exactly. So, fascinating. Was there, like the opportunity? I mean, I understand what will happen once you kind of fix this. But what are the typical things that you now see? I mean, you launched the product, you started to get your first customers in. What is the before and after? Is that, I mean, of course, there's productivity of people, but what else is improving?
Yes, I mean, it's about like making the process better, right? But also being able to sort of control the process, because you have, for the first time, many of our customers have real-time information about what is happening on the shop floor. I mean, often factories don't really know, will I achieve the output target, for example, by the end of the day? Or where is my problem currently? Which station has a problem? Which person maybe is struggling? Or where's a problem that I need to focus my energy on? And these are things that we make visible for the first time. So you, for the first time, really understand, okay, what is happening on the shop floor? You identify issues proactively, and you go away from just pure reaction and finding out what problems arose like a few hours ago or by the end of the shift that you haven't achieved the output, to a more proactive one that you know where to focus. Be, I mean, just like more proactive and be able to react faster.
Exactly. And I think this is also has a trickle effect on like what's happening in the rest of the process, right? Because if there's one bottleneck that is having more problems than the day before.
Yes, definitely. Yeah.
Then everything is it's multiplied.
Yes.
Yeah, exactly.
And maybe the other thing, which is also quite important, apart from making or increasing productivity, is also retaining know-how in the organization. I mean, this is a huge topic for many of our customers, that these workers work for like tens of years in a factory who are incredible, knowledgeable and experienced and have often a very unique way of doing certain things. But this know-how is usually isolated in the brains of the people, and because it's not formalized. And even if you ask them, they would not be able to tell you how they are, why are they doing something better than somebody else. They just do it. I mean, they're just like, just do it.
Exactly.
And this is something that we also uncover for the first time, basically. And for example, the use case of best practice is a very common theme across all of our customers, that we are able to detect all the different ways of working and identify the best way, basically, of working today. And it's often for our customers very surprising how the workers themselves have optimized the process. So you usually have like a standard operating procedure that an engineer has defined on how the process should be executed, but then the workers are doing it for years, right? Even if there's product variants, often the steps are similar, and then they have found a better way of doing certain things. And this is something that we make visible for the first time, allow to document, and then for the first time, use that information to train people more effectively. Yeah. So training is a big topic. Yeah?
Absolutely. I mean, a couple of weeks ago, I had Theo Seville on the podcast, who's the CEO of a company called Cloud NC.
Yeah.
A similar thing. His company is all about programming these machines. And that was never done because it's all in the heads of people, very experienced people that couldn't even bother about documenting it because, you know, it's what they did on a day-to-day basis. And this is huge.
Yeah, I just do it. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. So, I mean, is this only software or is it also IoT? I think it's a combination of things that you do, right? I mean, it's of course camera visualization.
Yes, correct. So we use cameras basically as the data source, as a sensor in the field. But this is like a commodity hardware. So we don't develop hardware ourselves. We just buy commodity off-the-shelf cameras. They're quite cheap, cost around 100 euros per camera. But it's a combination. Yeah, we need, because that's also the thing, right? The physical world, unlike the digital world, there's almost no data. Like a lot of things are not digitized in the physical operations. And factories are just one type of physical operations. Like you mentioned wholesale or logistics, very similar problem. A lot of physical operations that you don't have a lot of data about. Yeah. So and that's why we need a combination of hardware and software, basically. But the core IP and know-how of our company definitely is in the algorithm side, the software side.
Yeah, as long as people do it more and more and more and more, then the data starts to see the patterns of what is the optimal thing. Yeah. Yes. I mean, when I saw a couple of the videos, it made me think also about what to do in ice speed skating. And also, I think in cycling, like really also looking, okay, what is the posture of someone when he does the job or does the performance? I think you can go that far. So, yeah, okay.
The technology is also used quite a bit in football, right? That you start analyzing like football games automatically. Like the other day, I was like talking with somebody who they're working on digitizing, automating the scouting. So basically, that you're able to use a camera and just install it at a pitch, and then you have like this AI which is automatically scouting, and you can like process basically all the games all of a sudden, like every basically league. Every age, you can automatically start analyzing instead of having these scouts.
Yeah, opens up a lot of opportunity there. Yeah. Okay, so you started your company in 2022. Was that like when it was incubated, or did you really like start from there?
That's basically when we started. So end of 2022, we founded the company and started building the product beginning of last year, so 2023. So that's basically when we started. I mean, obviously, we had thought about the idea before, so we also worked together with Verontix, which is our venture studio from Berlin, where we sort of explored different ideas and then eventually basically decided on building what we currently do at Telsia.
Exactly. It's fascinating how fast you can build products these days. I mean, I come from the world where things were not in the cloud when I started, and it took years. So you have launched, you got customers. What has been an early decision? I mean, what I always try to do is to figure out, okay, there's so many options, there's so many different ways to approach a problem. So where do you start? So what have been an early decision that appears to be really powerful for how you solve the problem these days?
I mean, there's a lot of decisions, right, that you take, like both on the technical level and then like what kind of customers are you serving, who is the user that you're trying to focus on. And so we decided quite early on, for example, to not specifically target the two-wheelers of the world, like the automotive OEMs, who are basically the most, probably the best well-run manufacturing companies in the world. Also, there's use cases, obviously, also for our technology. I mean, there's no doubt about that. But I think a big opportunity is to help other, like the rest of the 98% other factories to come to a similar level than Toyota or Volkswagen is today. Because these companies traditionally don't have the resources, right? They don't have these hundreds of people focusing on process optimization. They haven't invested like hundreds of millions in IT systems. Yeah. And so the improvement level is a lot higher if you focus on sort of maybe more mid-market, but also vertical leading companies. And there's a big opportunity to help them basically leapfrog to the level that the automotive companies have achieved over the last, 30, 40, 50 years. I mean, lean manufacturing started in automotive, right? And these companies are doing it since like 50 years. Now, we, I think, can help the rest of the non-automotive OEMs to achieve the same level, but much faster and through technology.
Let me make a small interruption here. Max just made a critical remark about a crucial bet for his company. Who they're for and who they're not for. Of course, it's tempting to win the leaders of the world, like Volkswagen and Toyota. Who doesn't want those brands to proudly showcase on your website? But Max deliberately decided not to fall into this trap. They focus on creating the biggest possible impact for their customers. And that means companies who are not as advanced as the Toyotas and Volkswagens of this world. So they decided to deliberately focus on the underserved, the non-automotives, because there they can create the greatest leap. It's a trait remarkable SaaS companies master. They acknowledge that they cannot please everyone and aim to be different, not just better, and from there create something valuable and desirable. Trait number 1, 2, and 3 from my book, The Remarkable Effect. So you can master these traits as well. And the first step? Well, you like to guess it? Read my book. I've made the electronic version available for free. Just visit theremarkableeffect.com to grab your copy, and inspiration will spark within 10 minutes. Back to the interview. Funny. And it's really good that you mentioned that. I mean, I wrote my book, The Remarkable Effect, and the first trait that defines remarkable software companies is exactly around this. Acknowledge that you cannot please everyone. And the second one is deliver something that's valuable and desirable. And that has to do at the end with that you solve a problem that is more valuable and more critical to those customers than others. And I mean, for if you would go to Volkswagen, they'd likely have a look at you. Possibly they say, okay, good idea, we'll build it ourselves. But the problem for them is way less big problem than it is for the other parts of the market. So that's really good.
Yeah, I mean, we very early on, we visited quite a few of these OEMs as well. And then one of the OEMs we visited in Germany, and they were like, hey, if you can find me 1 second in this assembly line, that's a huge case for us. And we were like, okay, I mean, interesting challenge, but 1 second is not a lot, right? But and with the companies that we talk to, is like, we don't talk about seconds. It's more like
hours.
A lot. Yeah, minutes at least, hours at times, improvements. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that helps you, well, likely to give focus to what you try to solve and how you solve it. Have you taken a particular approach to come up with something that is giving you differential power? Defensible differentiation almost. I mean, and I realized that in a startup, you've not been around for long, but some choose to do the low-hanging fruit, others choose to do the hard things first.
Yeah.
What path have you chosen?
So I think we're in a difficult space, but we still try to pick the simpler problems, which are still already hard enough, I would say. And I mean, I think the differentiation in our case is, I mean, the end, the core IP is the division models that we have. And one of the core challenges and why it's so difficult to scale a software company in the manufacturing industry is just the way the manufacturing industry works. Like, you have a lot of different products, very different processes, very heterogeneous process. If you build like a system for like a sales process, like sales processes are much more uniform, right? Across many, many companies, manufacturing processes are very unique. And I think that we have built a system that can cope with that. So for example, one of the tricky things and what we do, one of the core use cases is manual assembly lines. And what you need to do, you need to be able to track products through the line to understand the cycle time, for example. And tracking cycle time without any sensors, just on a vision approach, is quite challenging because there's like an almost indefinite amount of different products, right? Even within a line, you have different variances across different lines in the same factory. You have different products across different verticals, different customers. So there's like, you don't even know what you can expect when you enter the next factory. And you need to be able to have a system that copes with this, these unknown unknowns, basically. And it's something that I think we've done quite well. Also coming from the experience from our co-founder, who worked in an autonomous driving industry, which has similar problems, maybe even more complicated, but it's even more dynamic environment. But if you have a car, there's so many cases around a car that it can happen that you can't account for all of them. You just basically have to build a system which is extremely adaptable to its environment. And yeah. I think that's what we have been building up in the last 1.5 years. And I assume you have at least, if not the best, one of the best vision models in the manufacturing industry. And over time, obviously, our competitive advantage comes from the data that we see. I mean, already our systems has seen tens of thousands of hours of manufacturing processes, and we have been able to improve it with every hour that our system sees the data. So eventually, our models will be very superior to many things.
Exactly.
And also the insights that we can provide, obviously, because we learn also about the process.
Yeah. The data these days becomes such a powerful part of the flywheel. I completely agree with you. And it is interesting what you just mentioned, because what you're doing at the end is looking, okay, what is happening in the various handlings in the process. You would never expect that following something across a longer trail is going to be the hardest nut to crack.
So the
devil is always in the detail.
Yeah. And so, I mean, this is one of the core things that we solve with our system. And then the next step, and that's even harder, is like track, for example, individual work steps. Because again, here, like now we basically know how is the product moving along the assembly line. We know how long people are working on the product, for example. But then having a very detailed understanding of what are all the steps that a person has done on the product, that's even more complicated. Because again, here, on the one hand, you need to be very precise, and you need to also cope with like a very wide range of activities that can happen. And here again, our system needs to be able to cope with the unknowns very well.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, it's fascinating. And I mean, that's also why I reached out to you, because I mean, I realize this cannot be an easy one, but it's if you fix it, it's massive. Let me see. So when did you first started to get the first customers up and running? What was the moment for that?
I mean, just right afterward that we started the company. So we basically launched the company with three customers that we have closed before starting the company. And then I think a few weeks after that, we went to the notary, we basically deployed our first cameras in the field.
Okay. You're talking about, of course, you're a startup. In this case, you're dealing with mid-market, not like the big enterprises. What has been... Yeah, explain a little bit, like, how did you get to your first 10 or 20 or 30 customers? What were the challenges that you didn't realize you'd face, but still did?
I mean, because our system is quite new, right? Like, if you talk with, like, most of the customers that we have or prospects that we talk to, they're here for these types of solutions for the first time. They're like, some of them, like, they have seen, like, similar solutions maybe, but there's not so many in the field. And many is like, oh, okay, I didn't know that even that something like this exists. So this is good and bad, right? Because we don't like have a lot of competition when we talk with customers. But on the other hand, we need to explain these systems for the first time. How does it work? How do you generate? How does the technology work? But also, how does it provide value? And these sort of things, which make it, I mean, it's a learning process. Like every time you explain it, then you get better and get the feedback and see like, how does your customer perceive your system? What words do they use when they describe your system? But this was definitely something that was like a normal learning journey for us as a company. And then, I mean, one thing that's obviously critical is, I mean, cameras, people are like skeptical of that because it's traditionally like...
privacy?
because of privacy, yes. Yeah, and usually it's used as a surveillance tool, right? You have a camera and then you have like a screen where you can see what's happening on the other side and you can play back and these sort of things. And we use the camera as a sensor, right? Like, so the only entity that looks at video streams is the AI, which is generating statistics, and then the video streams are deleted again. So it's a sensor approach, but that's new. And it's something that it requires quite a bit of explanation because it has not been done that often, especially in manufacturing. There's two use cases that people are using cameras for is like security, right? Like, to just check warehouses, if people are stealing material or like if people are breaking in basically in the warehouse to steal copper or whatever. And then quality inspection is also something where people are using cameras quite a bit. But for like digitizing processes, that's something that's quite new for people.
Yeah. I understand, yeah. Well, the question at the end is, if people see the value, they see the opportunity, do they quickly move over the objections? Or is it still something that kills deals?
I think the general idea of our system is quite easy to understand, especially for people in the domain. We talk a lot with people who do data collection manually, right? And they're like, wow, that's automatic. So I think this initial excitement is very, very quickly there. Mm-hmm. And then it's more about like, how do you like navigate all the internal processes? You have to talk with the IT, you have to talk with legal, you have to talk with unions, especially in work councils in Germany or in Europe quite a bit. So how do you navigate all of that, and how do you convince the internal stakeholders? Like, because often, like, we very quickly have a champion who's excited about a solution, he has a problem, he doesn't have visibility or spends a lot of time collecting data manually. But it's like, how do we enable this person? Because most of the sales is happening when you're not in the room, right? Like, how do you enable this person to explain something which is completely new, which is also sensitive because it involves cameras, these sort of things. How do you navigate that? Yeah,
exactly. So what did you learn there? What would you have liked to know, well, a year and a half back that you know now?
I mean, we changed also the way that we explain the system, right? This camera as a sensor approach. There's a lot of collateral that we generated, like extensive data privacy concept. We even now have templates for company agreements, like with the work council, with templates that we send to our customers. It helps also a bit. And then I think like also our learning for me was like just to address the point head on, right? Like, don't like pretend that cameras are not a critical issue. Like, it is, like, obviously, yeah, like, we bring cameras to the workplace, so address this thing very early on in the sales process, be very open and transparent about it, understand that people have like fear towards this technology because it's new. So there's something that we definitely changed quite a bit a lot on communication and explanation. And when you talk with prospects and stakeholders and the customers.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. That helps them to move the deal forward in a way. I mean, I'm not sure whether you've read the book, The Jolt Effect. There's, of course, always this thing in sales, whether a customer decides or not. And if they do decide not to pull the trigger, is it because of they don't understand the urgency? Or is it the other end, which is completely different, fear of messing up? Fear of messing up and fear of missing out. What do you believe the problem is on your end?
I mean, fear of missing out, so because it's a very new wave, I think in a few years, like, people will actively look for the solution that we are offering. It's a new thing. And I think the topic that we're addressing is basically shortage of skilled labor, right? And I think a few years ago, it was a sort of like a future problem. I think today, it depends a bit on the industry. It's very urgent or sort of like an afternoon problem. And I think in a few years, it will become a problem that needs immediate fixing because like factories will almost not be able to operate anymore.
And if their competitor is doing it, like now there is an urgency because they're going 20 times faster than we do.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. 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 So, I mean, the other day we talked with a CEO of a manufacturing company and he asked us, VP of operations to create a list of the amount of people that are about to retire in the next 5 years on the shop floor. And it was like, I think like it was 30% or something or 35% of the people. And especially the experienced ones, right? Like that they're going to retire, obviously. So there's a lot of know-how that's gone, a lot of like manpower that is gone. And this is something that, I mean, today, like they're not leaving, but in 3, 4, 5 years, they will all, like a lot of them will leave. And then this becomes a very serious problem.
Exactly. Yeah, true. One question that is, there's always an interesting thing, and especially I think also in the area where you operate, what is the status quo in this domain that you passionately disagree with?
That's an interesting one. I think like maybe not only manufacturing, but in general, like if you look at, for example, investors, like how they think about manufacturing startups or like companies like building software systems, I think there's always a tendency to say that manufacturing companies don't want to buy software. And I think, yes, they are more conservative, but it's just the nature of their business because it's a low margin business and every minute of downtime, it's very, very costly. On the other hand, if I compared like the Tesla solution that I was selling before, also the offering is not so good, right? I think like for a factory, like it sounds obvious you need to digitize, but then the manufacturing domain is just complicated. And I think AI for the first time offers, like the one of our solutions, one example of that, of a completely new experience, right? So before that, we were installing tablets and integrating into machines. It took like months or years to roll out a solution, a system. Now with AI, we just like hang out a sensor and we get all the data that we need. And then on top of it, we can now start using LLMs and these sort of things to make use of the data for the first time too. Now before that, we were collecting a lot of data, which didn't have a lot of context and which was very hard to interpret. And it was not as useful as it maybe sounded. And now for the first time, things are changing, I think. This will also dramatically change how manufacturing companies think about software because the companies that we talk to, they're very interested in ways of improving. It's just the offering so far was probably not ideal, especially when it comes to shop floor process. Yeah,
that's true. I think that that's what the industry has been suffering with for so many years. I mean, just look, for example, I come from the ERP space, which is, of course, also a big thing in manufacturing. It's about the processes. Years of implementation.
It's just inherently complex, right? It's not like that nobody knows how to build like a good ERP. It's just like incredibly complicated domain. But then not new technology. I think this, our vision approach as an example is like for the first time enabling a completely new experience. Yeah.
Yeah. But that's, of course, also what fascinated me. I mean, I wrote my book, The Remarkable Effect, which is about the kind of what defines those software companies that build products and solutions that people talk about. I mean, what you do by design almost is something that people talk about because of it, how new it is. Yeah, it's worth making a remark about and so on. As an entrepreneur, do you optimize for that? What do you decide to do or not to do that helps make the product stand out in the market?
I mean, in the end, like you always need to think about your customer, right? Like how do you make your customer happy and as many customers as possible? I mean, it sounds very simple, but this really helps. I mean, we don't like look a lot about how other companies are doing it. I mean, obviously we look left and right to understand the competition a bit, but it's mostly about like, how can we fix these problems for our customers? And also, I mean, obviously, I mean, there's like, because the manufacturing is like, everybody has a bit unique needs. Sometimes you also need to really focus on the problems that you see across your customers. So there's also a lot of things you say and you have to say no to, right? Just to make sure that you build a standard product that you can scale, which in the end is also for the benefit of the for the customer. So maybe to give you an example, I mean, in principle, with vision technology, you can capture anything, right? Also, like all the work steps, all the material components, every screw, you could like be able to track that using vision, but it's very difficult to do this in a scalable way. Like, obviously, you can like train a system very uniquely for one station, for one line, and you label a lot of data, and this would make the person managing line very happy, but the factory in itself would not be very happy because it would be extremely expensive to roll it out. It would take like many, many years to roll it out. So that's why we are sort of like a bit higher level cycle times as an example. And then is somebody working on a product or not working on a product, which basically everybody needs. And you can assess it that it can roll out quite quickly. So you always, or that's at least our approach, always to think about the scalability, also to the benefit of the factory, obviously.
Very good answer. I mean, I actually wrote a post about it this morning that there's always thousands of ideas that you could do, driven by either your ideal customers, very often also by customers that are not ideal, but they want it to be ideal. So they push you in different ways there exactly as well.
Yep.
And it just drags you down, you know? How many developers do you have? I mean, if you have 20 today, or you have 200 tomorrow, or 2,000 in a couple of years, that will never be enough. And it's just because of what you just said.
Yeah.
How do you make those decisions? Yeah, great answer. Last question. From the lessons that you've learned starting companies, running companies, being the entrepreneur in the space, what are the tidbits of wisdom that you've gained over time that you'd like to share with other tech entrepreneurs? I mean, what would be a do and what would be a don't?
Yeah. I mean, yeah, the thing that I just mentioned, I'm focused on the customer. I think when in doubt, like think in your customer's shoes. Sounds again simple, but then it really helps drive certain decisions. I think focusing on the team is what we do. Like we spend so much time now in hiring, like not only making sure that people have like the technical expertise, like when you're looking for an engineer or like you look for a salesperson, does this person like have the basics and the tool set of selling, but making sure that the cultural fit is there, the motivation is there. And something that obviously also I personally learned what to look for in people, because sometimes it's so hard to find really good talent, like sometimes you have the tendency to maybe compromise a bit just to fill the position because you urgently need a new engineer. And then you're like, okay, I screened out 500 CVs and fuck it, let's take somebody just to get this role or position filled. But this always hurts you in the end, because especially if you want to scale, you need somebody who can really do the job and you can rely on 100%. So that's why we have like now, I think like 4 or 5 steps in the interview. We do like an on-site for one day. We also get to know the person, do cultural fit interviews, do technical interviews, like a lot of things to make sure that the person fits in the team.
Yeah, exactly. Of course, it's an audition from the other side, but it's like figuring out what the red flags and the yellow flags are to say no and then don't go. Yeah. Have you got a framework for that?
Which reminds me personally, I for that, for hiring is quite a bit of gut feeling, just of experience. Things that you can check easier is like technical skills, right? Or like sort of hard skills, marketing, does somebody know about performance marketing, these sort of things. Like the other thing, like the motivation of a person is a bit harder, but you see it when what the person did before, right? How the person thinks about, like I always ask for learnings, for example, how are they reflecting about what they did? And if there's not a lot of reflection and not a lot of reasons for the things that the person did, then that's usually not a good sign. Yeah. Because you can do like stupid things, right? But then you have to reflect on it and then you have to learn something out of it and then you have to like act also on it, right? just reflecting and don't doing with it is also, it's not the point, right? So these are things that I look for. It's a more intuitive framework maybe, but these are things that I'm trying to focus on when I talk with people.
Makes a lot of sense. It's always in the type of questions that you ask and the way people respond to that. Okay. So where can people go to find out more about your company, Deltia, and to say hi to you?
Our website, deltia.ai, my LinkedIn profile. Very happy to anybody who wants to chat about manufacturing, whatever. Just write me a personal message. I'm happy to respond and have a chat there.
Perfect. Okay. Well, thank you very much. This was, I like this, the journey that you're on. Interesting to see what you're doing on the innovation side and how that can change manufacturing, change wholesale distribution in a pretty interesting way. So good luck on the next part of the journey.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks for inviting me and thanks for the questions.
It's an absolute pleasure. Thank you.
And this ends my conversation with Max. And I hope you enjoyed it. And if so, please leave a review on iTunes. And if it inspired you, please share it with other tech entrepreneurs on a mission that you have in your network. Other than that, thank you for tuning into this podcast. I had the honor to speak to Max Fischer, founder and CEO of Deltia. As said, the goal that I have in this podcast is twofold. Firstly, to inspire new forms of value creation by sharing compelling ideas and stories about the potential we can unlock when technology and people blend in the right way. And secondly, share experiences from tech entrepreneurs like you about what is required to create a remarkable software business and how to overcome the roadblocks to do so. Before I close, I have two more comments to make. If you know other tech entrepreneurs on a mission that have a story worth sharing, please send me an email at ton.dobby@valueinspiration.com. Building the momentum all starts with revealing the ideas, and that starts with you. And if you want to know more about my book, or you're interested in joining the Remarkable Effect tribe, please visit my website at www.valueinspiration.com. Thanks for tuning in. And you could do me a big favor by rating the podcast on iTunes or provide me with your feedback directly. I'll see you shortly on a new episode.